allows us. Now, let me add, we would much rather go back and have our original proposal. We realize there are legal problems with it. This approach with the deed notice is not a perfect solution. We recognize that. But that, together with the assessors providing us with the notice, seems to be the best we can achieve in the context of the legalities of the situation now. If there are better ways up front to deal with it, we're certainly willing to look at them and address them. But we're not aware of any at this point that don't create greater problems than what this does.
Representative Bellamy.
I want you to know, above board, I have a bias. I have a real estate license. And we use it in the earnest money transaction. I think it would be useless in the deed. And I find that very interesting. By the time people get around to doing the deed, they're ready to buy. They've gone through the hassle. They've got their money. They're down at the title office or in the attorney's office, and they're all sitting there, and I just really disagree that they at that point go to the planning office and say, maybe I better check this language. I think they do it at the earnest money time.
I think if we could do it at earnest money.
Well, now, wait a minute. You folks said you have people coming in and telling you that they read their deed and come in, and I just would be very shocked to find that that's what's happening. I would say they're coming in with their earnest money. They're reading this warning and saying, what does this warning mean? Not at the time they're signing the deed.
Representative Bellamy, I can't say whether people saw it on the deed or on the earnest money agreement. All I'm reporting to you is what people at this meeting said, which was, yes, indeed, people have come in and said, we read this disclaimer. What does it mean? And we do what we want with our property.
Would you indicated somebody's come into your office now. Would you agree? I mean, I would find it just shocking to find out that at the time everybody's down there looking at that instrument and ready to close the deal, that they all of a sudden say, whoops, maybe I better go to the planning department and find out what this language is. If they came into your office and checked, probably they did it at the time of the earnest money warning.
Representative Bellamy, I've gone under the assumption that since the law didn't require it, most realtors were not putting that wording into the earnest money agreements and the escrow agreements, and therefore that the comments and the questions that we have had to be the result of it being in the deed. Now, if there are groups that are voluntarily doing it in the earnest money stage, that might be what's triggering. And I certainly would encourage that. But our understanding was if we wrote a law that said that it just needs to be done at that one point, that there were some deed and contract situations that did not involve earnest money agreements or escrow agreements, and that we would miss those. And so we wanted to catch it at the point where we caught most of the transactions, recognizing there was a trade-off and it's a little later in the process.
The Realtors Association Executive Secretary is here, but my understanding, we were told in our realty office by the realtors through their professional education program that we must include this information on every earnest money agreement. That was the law. And I think that's what the realtors, and we could find out, have put out, is that that needs to be on the transaction, the initial agreement. The only other statement is, as a realtor, I think I'd love to get planners to sign off and say what the zoning is on a piece of property, because I haven't dealt with any more group of individuals that are so afraid to tell people what they can do or not do as a group of individuals. That I'd love to get you folks to sign off and say, yes, this is what you can do, and no, this is what you can't do. Because my experience tells me that you folks don't want to make that statement.
Well, Representative Bellamy, all I can tell you is that people that come into my office and say, what's the zoning on my property? I can hand them a copy of that zone, and they can take it to their attorney or whatever and look at it, and I'm more than willing to explain what I understand it means. Now, the lawyers have tripped me up, so I'm not always right in terms of what my own zoning ordinance says, but I can go a long way to answering most of the common everyday kinds of questions.
When you make the statement that you would like to have to sign off, what you're not saying is that you want to tell that person that this is what they can do, because you and I know very well that the lawyers have tripped you up, and if you were legally held responsible for signing off on a piece of property as a planner, what people could do with that property, your association would come unglued, because zoning happens to change.
Well, Representative Bellamy, let me respond by saying that if the person wanted a letter that said that at this point in time, I am allowed to do the following use on my property, I have no compunctions about sending that kind of a letter. And I would probably put a disclaimer on it, be aware that the law may change. But if they want something in writing that says that the day we go and record this deed, I'm going to be able to come in and get a building permit, I'll sign that kind of a letter. And I don't think our association would have a problem with that.
Representative Burton.
I guess I read this, and I don't think this says as much as everybody seems to say. The level of discussion here seems to be sort of saying this. My understanding of what this warning does is a little bit like what's on a cigarette box. Is that this may be hazardous to your health. Going to a doctor may be hazardous to your health. Going to an attorney may be hazardous.
Buying property anymore can be hazardous to your health.
I understand what the intent of this was. It was to sort of flag people who may purchase properties that they really, before they finalize the purchase of that property, ought to go to the county or city planning office to find out what the appropriate uses are. It's just a real good idea to go check. Now, when they do that, they walk in and are subject to whatever process they have at the counter or the office that they're into. And I would assume that the normal procedure would be to, since has everybody now got an approved plan under an approved most jurisdictions. There's a few places in the county and state that aren't working out so well, but those are codified, available, and I would assume you'd make that available as per se. Here's what's there. Beyond that, your legal responsibility as a planner stops at that point. I mean, you don't verify, you're not approving, you're not signing off. You use those terms. Your function as a county planner or a planner of any sort in official capacity, as far as approval or disapproval of the use, is not there, because it's the council that adopts and the county that adopts and LCDC that approves the use, and those are, if you want to go to planning, but the zones specifically are approved by the local jurisdiction. You can't, and I couldn't as a buyer walk in and say, look, I just bought X piece of property down here, will you verify and I can hold you harmful on this if it doesn't in fact have that appropriate use. We're not doing that. That isn't the intent of this, is it? This intent of this is simply to flag to people, go check it out before you sign for it. Isn't it as simple as that?
Well, let me respond, Representative Burton. First of all, I don't know that that's the intent, but I think the outcome is every zoning ordinance I've ever worked under delegated authority to the zoning administrator or the person in that ordinance to issue those kinds of determinations in writing. And I realize that, you know, if I get taken to court, maybe as a governmental employee, I'm not personally liable for that determination. But the fact is, I have represented what that ordinance says, and I should be smart enough to know that if I don't know what the ordinance says, I refer it to my legal counsel and get them to help me out with a legal opinion on that kind of a situation.
Well,
so we can give more and more definite answers on what the ordinances do say than maybe what we could have 10 or 20 years ago.
You're in a vast minority, though.
Well, you're doing two things to me here. One is I think you're shooting yourself in the foot. I don't think that that's the intent, and maybe you were here when they put this through the last legislative session, so you know more about what the intent is here than I do. But I don't see this as an intent to ask a legal opinion of a planner. I see this as an intent to tell a potential buyer to check to see what the appropriate zoning and use of that land is. Now, beyond that, the way in which it goes, it simply says, go check it out. And it says specifically, should check with the appropriate, check. Check, doesn't say, go get a legal opinion, go get something in writing from the planner. It just says, go check it. That's all it says. So we're not asking you to do anything more than that. This is not that. If it's more than that, then I would have a concern about having that language in here at all.
No,
if in fact it puts you at risk, I wouldn't want this language to be in there. But I think it doesn't do that. It just simply tells the buyer, go check it out. It's a good idea. And that's why I'm saying maybe, you know, I agree. I think we're agreeing with each other. Okay. And I just wanted to find, I think what I guess is on this thing is I'd rather see this in the deed, even if people don't read this as well as they should.
as a not having it in the deed, but the better piece of legislation perhaps you'd be dealing on would be to find a way to let people know about this sooner rather than later.
Let me just suggest this. After the hearing, we can check, because I think 93040 does say, or contracting to transfer fee title, and that sounds like an earnest money agreement.
That's really a land sale contract.
That's just for land sale.
It's a land sale contract.
Mr. Stacy from 1,000 Friends also wanted to comment. Did you have some comments that were not duplicative of earlier testimony?
Chairman, members of the committee, Bob Stacy, staff attorney with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'll speak only to those matters that haven't been addressed already. I should say that I was on the short end of a vote of the real estate and land use section by which it took action to recommend repeal of this section. The bar has made three arguments today, at least two of which are weighty, but I think those two go to amending the current statute rather than repealing it. The third is the Pandora's box argument that this is an invitation or a precedent for further burdening the deed records process with social concerns lying outside its domain. And I would urge you not to repeal the current statute on that basis if there are other proposals to further burden the title transfer process or the deed face with further declaratory statements or further requirements on the deeds records officers of the county. That will be handled as they arise rather than being used as an argument to repeal the existing statute. But there are two points raised by the bar which may merit amendment. I'm sorry, I was unaware that this matter was before the committee today and appeared here by accident. I have neither written testimony nor proposed amendments. But the questions raised were, does this void the conveyance at issue if the statement is left out? It would seem appropriate for the legislation to state that the failure to include such a statement gives rise to a right of action on the part of the purchaser against the seller, but this doesn't by its own operation void the conveyance. The point is raised that the seller may wish to warrant the particular uses can be made of a particular parcel of land, and again it would seem appropriate to amend the statement required to make specific reference to any warranties appearing on the face of the deed to exclude them from the general statement. If the committee is interested in pursuing amendments and schedules this bill for work session, we'd be pleased to propose language on both those points. Otherwise, we would urge that this bill not be adopted.
Questions from the committee? Representative Bellamy.
Bob, if we put it in there that required it on the earnest money or the initial transaction, would that still be getting to the problem and where it should be done?
I'm probably not the best person to ask about that. I get involved in land use cases after those measures are signed. But the question goes to the efficacy of this notice provision. It's a good question. As the planners stated, their proposal was to have a much firmer requirement. There actually be a checkoff. If there is a more efficacious point in the process, by all means, that would be identified.
Can property be sold and recorded? I want to have and recorded. Nowadays in the state of Oregon, that it does presently have a tax law, can it be done without going through the planning department?
Yeah. A conveyance of property from one person to another.
That doesn't have a tax lot?
That doesn't have a tax lot.
Now, at this present in the state, is it possible to convey title to property that does not have a tax lot?
In account.
And record it. I realize I can sell a piece of property to anybody as a gentleman's agreement, but to record that, doesn't it have to go through the planning department now?
There are counties, Representative Bellamy, that don't have minor land partition ordinances, and they're not required to by state law. I suppose in that instance it would be possible to convey a parcel and record the partition without having obtained county approval. Yes. But not in a county that has a minor partition ordinance, I think.
Further questions, Representative Bunn?
Bob, if we amended the statute to make it clear that omitting this language did not create a defective transfer, if a person who was involved in a number of transfers chose to leave the language out, what would be the remedy, or what would be the penalty on that person for having left the language out?
Well, my law school training, Representative Bunn, suggested a right of rescission on the part of the landowner, on the part of the purchaser, would be an appropriate remedy. I don't know if it necessarily follows unless it's stated in the statute. But that's the beneficiary of that warning statement, the purchaser. And if the purchaser is deprived of the benefit that the statute requires, then arguably at least that person should have a right of rescission.
Thanks. Thank you. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2359 and move on to House Bill 2360. Mr. Carter, would you like to join us again?
Don Carter again on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Real Estate and Land Use Section. I believe that this can safely be characterized as a technical bill to clean up the provisions of ORS Chapter 93 that refer to joint tenancies, which are abolished in Oregon under ORS 93.180. And again, I regret that I did not have written testimony to present to you today. I understand that there is a complicated legislative history that explains why ORS 93.180 did away with joint tenancies, and yet that language was retained in ORS 93.190 and 93.200. And I will submit, or the bar will submit, written testimony and a memorandum explaining that legislative history. But the purpose of this bill is simply to make consistent the Oregon statutes to specifically state that the form in which trustees or personal representatives take the property is as tenants in common with the right of survivorship, not a joint tenancy. Substantively, I don't think it changes anything.
Good.
That was too easy.
Well, confess you're still thinking about
it. Yeah.
Well,
maybe I'll just maybe defer to the attorneys on the committee. I guess I had a question, and if a party mortgages his interest, one of the parties mortgage an interest or somehow place an encumbrance on that tenancy, and the one party dies, and that party dies. So what happens to the rights of the other party in that tenancy? I mean, do you have to sell? Let's talk about the marriage situation,
okay?
Because that's probably one of the most common. Now, if I'm married, I encumber it, I die, what happens in terms of my spouse's rights and that?
Okay. First, the marriage relationship in the form of ownership in a marriage would be slightly different than
maybe
what we're talking about here.
Okay, should we not use that example and use you?
It's an analogous situation, but it's a different
form
of tenancy. That's tenancy by the entirety as opposed to...
How about if Representative Springer and I buy a house
together? Okay.
Right.
And Representative
Springer... Which he would never do, believe me.
And Representative Springer were to die first...
Thank you.
The remaining interest in the property...
Seniority.
...under this statute in either form, I believe, would pass to you. Or that's the intention of the statute, that the entire remaining ownership interest would pass to you, which is what the survivorship language provides. Now, whether Representative Springer would be able to borrow money against his interest as a joint tenant in common with the right of survivorship is doubtful, because there probably aren't very many banks that would want to lend Representative Springer the money as a joint tenant with the right of survivorship, because he might die first, and then the bank or the lending institution wouldn't have anything, any lien on the property, because it would be your property free and clear of that lien.
Oh, okay.
Unless you signed off on his loan.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody out there that wants to testify on this bill? Thank you. Let's move along here and have a hearing on House Bill 2361. This will stay with us.
I do have some written testimony on this bill that I'd be happy to. The written testimony indicates this bill is supported by the Oregon State Bar Real Estate Land Use Section. It is also our understanding that the bill is supported by the Debtor-Creditor Section and by the Oregon Association of Realtors, who will submit written testimony in support of the bill. I should note that as I go through the bill and answer any questions with respect to each section of the bill, there is one minor modification that the Oregon Association of Realtors has indicated they would like to see in here, and I'll refer to that one to get to it. Just by way of background, typically in Oregon, land sale contracts have three different types of remedies available to the seller in the event of a default under the contract, and those three remedies are strict foreclosure, specific performance, and forfeiture. And the remedy of strict foreclosure requires the filing of a court action and permits the court will grant the buyer a limited period of time between the entrance of an interlocutory decree of strict foreclosure and the final decree, within which to pay what is remaining on the contract, and to thereby cure the default. The remedy of specific performance also requires the filing of a court action, and under Oregon law, after the court decrees specific performance of the contract, there is no redemption period, and the vendor is entitled to a deficiency judgment against the vendee. Now, the forfeiture remedy is the one that we're talking about here. It's a remedy that allows the contract seller to declare the contract forfeited and of no further force and effect. And many of the form contracts in use around the state and the forms that are contained, that attorneys often look at, do contain the forfeiture remedy. There are some deficiencies with the forfeiture remedy in that depending on the type of remedy, the type of provision for forfeiture in the contract, the buyer may or may not be entitled to notice of the default and an opportunity to cure the whatever the default is. The Oregon courts have held that if the provision is self-executing, which means that it does not require any, there are no alternative remedies in the contract. There's only one remedy, and that's forfeiture. If the contract provides only that one remedy, then there is no notice required for the buyer, and the buyer has no right to cure the default, and basically that's the end of it. The buyer gets the property back. As a practical matter, In the present system, it may be necessary for the seller to file a suit to quiet title, or an action in ejectment to get the purchaser out of the property. But under the present state of the law, as recently as the Brownstein versus Trottier case in 1982, the Oregon Court of Appeals has said that forfeiture remedy is enforceable in Oregon. All right. Even if the provision is not self-executing, and there are alternative remedies, as is true of most real estate contracts, the courts have varied how much time the buyer is allowed to cure the default. In one case that I've cited in the letter, the court said 5 days was enough notice. And in another case, the court said 10 days was enough. In another case, the court said 2 weeks was enough. If the default is not just a monetary default, but say something concerning the use of the property or some other kind of default, that may be a very short period of time within which to cure the default, and it may impose a great hardship on the buyer. The purpose of this bill is to clarify what kind of notice is required to set up a procedure whereby the buyer has the opportunity to cure the default, and to provide an opportunity for those who hold an interest subordinate to the buyer to also cure the default. In other words, if the buyer went out to get a second mortgage, for example, on his home, this bill would require the second mortgagee to be notified of the default and would provide the second mortgagee the right to cure the default. And I'm using the term second mortgagee loosely. What I mean is a mortgagee on the vendee's interest, or an assignee of the vendee's interest. And if I say something that doesn't make any sense, let me know. I'll try to clarify.
Representative Bond.
Could I ask a question in that regard? If you had, and I have to admit I haven't read the bill at this point, but if you had a situation where a vendee the contract says that the vendee can't sell without prior written consent won't be unreasonably withheld. Mm-hmm. Vendee sells without consent to a flake off somewhere, mm-hmm. and you can't find that person. Does this require you to give that third person out there notice?
The bill defines a purchaser as a successor in interest to the purchaser's contract rights of whom the seller has actual or constructive notice. So if there is no recording of the contract assignment by the vendee, then the contract vendee is not entitled to any notice. However, if there is a recorded assignment of contract, of the vendee's interest in the contract, then the bill does require notice to be given to that contract vendee. And there is a procedure for giving notice to that assignee. It's found in Section 3 of the bill, and it requires to one of the following addresses, if known, and then the residence, the mailing address, the current address. If none of those is known, a forwarding address from the last known, and so forth. There's a list of who has to be notified and how they can be found.
Let me express the concern, if I might. I had a client who sold a piece of property. That party sold the property to a vast array of people of varying levels of responsibility. There was a lot of problem with giving notices and that sort of thing. Would it be appropriate, in your opinion, to set up, and perhaps it doesn't in the bill, but set up a method of giving notice by representative? So that if you've lost control as a vendor through no fault of your own but through the vendee's fault, that you limit your responsibility to give notice on down the way?
Well, I think that's a valid concern. It may be that in an instance where there are numerous assignees or numerous subordinate lien holders, that the seller will want to weigh whether it would be better to do one of the judicial forms of notice, such that there can be publication or some other method. That this bill the forfeiture remedy does represent an attempt to provide an easier method for the contract vendor to foreclose the interest. But where the vendee has messed the situation up by selling it to numerous people, it may not be possible for the vendor to do that.
Okay.
I'll hit some highlights of the bill. The summary that I've provided in here goes through it and tries to do the same things. Attached also to the letter are some statutes from some other states that you might want to take a look at. You may not, but...
Mr. Carter?
Yes?
Could I ask, Representative Bauman is here and he's taking a break and needs to get back to Ways and Means.
Yes.
And could we just take a few minute break to hear his testimony on the next bill and we can devote more time?
You bet.
Thank you very much. We'll temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 2361 and open the hearing on House Bill 2531. Representative Bauman, welcome to the House Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I am Representative Rick Bauman from Portland. I'm here in support of House Bill 2531, which really takes care of, I hope, and addresses an imbalance in the law and really fairly interesting little glitch.